So I'd like to call to order the September 10th meeting of the MTC Policy Advisory Council because we have a quorum now. So welcome back, everybody. I hope you've been having a good summer. And we will take our first agenda item, which is approval of the July 9th meeting minutes. Moved by Rich, seconded by Gerald. All in favor? Any noes? Any abstentions?
Abstain, I wasn't here.
Thank you, Carlos. And with that, the minutes are approved. So we don't have any comment cards, but at this point we take public comment on items not on the agenda. Seeing none, let's move forward with subcommittee reports. And if Naomi could present on the Equity and Access Subcommittee, please.
Oh, no, that's fine. Thank you. Okay. Oh, good afternoon. So we had a very interesting Equity and Access Committee meeting earlier. The first major item was the Lifeline Transportation Program Cycle 4 Draft Guidelines. And the Lifeline funding is a combination of different sources of funding, which includes state transit assistance STA funds, Proposition 1B transit funds, and Section 5307 Job Access and Reverse Commute, or JARC, funds. And this funding is usually done, even though the funding comes through MTC, it's done on a county level by the CMAs, the process that distributes these funding. So there's some changes, even though this has been going on for a while, there are some changes in the newest cycle, which is upcoming. And the biggest one, and it caused us some unhappiness in the committee, is that the JARC funds were previously really available to non-transit recipients, and because of a number of factors related to how the 5307 is distributed now, that's really not an option. And those really come down from the federal level, so there's not really anything we can do about that. It's how Congress wrote MAP 21. But we were disappointed that some of the non-traditional transportation providers would not have that eligibility anymore, per se. I mean, there are some roundabout ways it could happen, but it just didn't seem very likely. Some of the other things, changes were a suggestion to set aside some of the money for a means-based fare project recommendation, which I'll talk a little bit more because that was our second item. And they also are giving the CMAs the option of adding some points or preference for projects that have mobility managers or are tied to consolidated transportation service agencies, but that's really an option for the counties to address. They've also updated the low-income population factors and transit ridership factors for the formulas. And they've also updated the communities of concern. So they've tried to incorporate all the new data. So those were the major changes there. And then our second item was this regional means-based transit fare pricing study. And by that, we mean low-income transit fare pricing study. And so this came out of, so the first part of this project came as a result of input from several different sources. These include the coordinated plan, the Lifeline Transportation Program, some of the funding requests that have come to the MTC to assist with fare assistance programs, basically, the Regional Transportation Plan, the Transit Sustainability Project, and the Community-Based Transportation Plan. So basically, the idea is that there's been a lot of interest in looking at funding assistance for low-income peoples. And so that's why they wanted to do this study. And it's going to have three primary objectives: to make transit more affordable for low-income residents, to move towards a more consistent regional standard for fare discount policies, and to be financially viable and administratively feasible without adversely affecting the transit system's service levels and performance. So they've put out an RFP. They're going to hire a consultant to do this study, and they're putting together a TAC to help oversee this study. And so they are soliciting input into the TAC. It's going to be a mixture of transit operators of large and small size and low-income and equity representatives and human service representatives. And we had some discussion within the subcommittee about sort of the mixture of the TAC and also sort of how that information is going to be disseminated to other interests. It looks like input from this project is going to be made regularly to the Equity and Access Subcommittee. So as I said, they are soliciting recommendations for the TAC. So if you would like more specific information, I'm pretty sure this packet's on the web. So you could see more about what they're talking about for the TAC and how to contact Kristen. She would need those recommendations by next Friday. So that's my summary. Does anybody from the subcommittee have something they want to add to that? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Naomi. So we'll move on to agenda item 5, which is the Regional Goods Movement Plan update, and we'll hear from Carolyn Clevenger.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Carolyn Clevenger with MTC's Planning Committee. Planning Section, presenting to many committees these days. Just wanted to give you an update on the Regional Goods Movement Plan that we're working on. As some of you might recall, when we adopted Plan Bay Area, goods movement was identified as one of the key work areas to advance before the next RTP update. So earlier this year, MTC kicked off an update to the Regional Goods Movement Plan. We had last done a full plan in 2004. With some interim work, but this is the sort of next time that we'll be redoing the full Regional Goods Movement Plan. At the same time, Alameda County CTC was proceeding with a county goods movement plan, so we are doing this in coordination with them in order to use resources most efficiently. You know, a lot of the data and analysis will be very similar, so we're working in collaboration with them. There will be two different plans coming out of this work, but just wanted to highlight for you that we're doing a lot of work in coordination with them. So, you know, sort of why goods movement? Obviously, it's an integral part of the region's economy. Just almost a third of jobs in the region are tied to goods movement-related industries. And it's a really key source of job diversity in the region. So there has been some work that I think many of you are aware of as part of the HUD Prosperity Grant that's looking at different workforce development opportunities, and we're working with them to see how we can partner in moving some of that piece of goods movement forward. It's also heavily reliant on the transportation system. We have major ports in this region, major airports in this region, as well as highway and rail corridors that connect us both within our region as well as to the rest of the country. And then on the local side, local streets and roads are very heavily impacted by goods being delivered and trucks on local streets and roads. And with that comes significant public health and quality of life impacts. On local communities, particularly those that are in proximity to major goods movement facilities or infrastructure in the region. Just to give you, the next few slides will just give you a sense of sort of what is moving within our region. You see that the vast majority of goods are domestic, which means they have a starting and end point in this country. I think we often think of goods movement as being, you know, big containers moving through the ports, but the vast majority of our goods are actually just serving local residents and local businesses. We do expect on the growth forecast side that exports is actually expected to grow faster than imports or domestic over the next about 25 years. So I think the Bay Area in our role as an export region for the Central Valley and other production going on within the Bay Area is well positioned to try and take advantage of some of the economic development opportunities with exports. In terms of what commodities are actually flowing in out within the Bay Area, you see a lot of high-value products like electronics, machinery, precision instruments, automobiles. And that has to do with our region's role as a major consumer center. Relatively, the region is a pretty wealthy region overall. We consume a lot of goods and services within this region. You'll also see a handful of different categories related to foodstuffs, alcoholic beverages, things like that that are synonymous with the region. As well as you'll see a number of things related to gasoline, petroleum, and fuels. So there are obviously there are a lot that we're consuming here as everyone gets around, but also materials coming into our refineries, primarily along the Carquinez Strait in Contra Costa County and Solano County. As I mentioned, it's a major source of jobs in the region. Approximately a third of jobs within the region come from goods movement dependent industries. There's sort of the obvious things in manufacturing, construction, wholesale, as well as the transportation sector itself. We are breaking all of this data down to the county level. That's one of the tasks that's underway right now so that counties can get a better sense of the distributions within their counties. And we'll be providing that to all of the CMAs to work with for their planning efforts. In terms of our overall project, this chart gives you a sense of a lot of the different goods movement studies and initiatives that are underway in the state. The center two boxes on the right side, the MTC Goods Movement Plan and Alameda County's plan, as I mentioned, are the two plans that we're working on right now. And they'll both feed into our respective county and regional plans. So our Goods Movement Plan will be complete in time to feed into our next RTP in 2017. Whereas theirs will feed into the next countywide plan, which I know is one of the items you'll be talking about later today. And we are working very closely with the state. Caltrans is currently developing a state freight plan. They have a draft out right now, and they'll be finishing it by the end of the year. And District 4 here, Caltrans District 4 office, completed some work a couple of months ago that is actually providing a lot of the base data for our work. So we're building off of that and utilizing most of the data that they've used, that they put together, that feed into the state plan. The state plan is really in response to recommendations from the federal government as part of the last federal authorization, MAP 21. They recommended, they did not require, but they strongly recommended states to have state freight plans. And so Caltrans is doing their plan in response to the MAP 21 recommendations. For the outreach for our plan, we have a very multi-layered engagement process. We have what we're calling our executive team, which meets about quarterly. And that's executives from some of the key transportation agencies, as well as the air district within the region who are working on goods movement. And that's to really get their buy-in from an agency level that they're committed to working on goods movement issues and trying to advance towards some common advocacy principles. We have our technical team. We have been using the Partnership Technical Advisory Committee. We are going to be expanding that to include members of the ROG, so we'll be creating a separate subcommittee this next month. Because what we've found is that with goods movement, you need people who are interested in it and working with it to engage on a regular basis, and going to some of the standing committees doesn't get us that concentrated input that we really need. So we'll be making a call to PTAC and ROG this month for volunteers to serve on a subcommittee, similar to what we did with the equity work during the plan where we had the subcommittee of the ROG. And then we'll be meeting with you throughout the course of this project to keep you updated as we develop strategies. We've recently, or probably in the next 2 weeks, we'll be finishing the first round of our interest group meetings. We've done about 30 so far, and these are very targeted meetings with interest group throughout the region, from both private sector, economic development, business groups, public health groups, environmental community groups. We've met with labor. And we're trying to have meetings now to talk about what are the needs and issues and opportunities that they see, what issues they want us to study as we move forward with the plan. And that's going to, I'll show you some of what we've heard to date later on in the presentation. And then we'll be going back out to them with two more rounds of this very targeted outreach as we start developing strategies and finish our needs assessment, and then when we have the draft plan. In addition, we are doing a series of six roundtables, some which will be sort of bigger events, others will be focused more on specific technical or sort of interest area issues. We've held our first one in July. We had about 100 people attend, and they're really to bring people from all the different interest groups together to hear each other's issues, to talk about goods movement, and to try and sort of draw some more attention to goods movement within the region. We'll be doing, as I mentioned, we did one in July. We'll be doing one this fall in West Oakland to really talk about some community impacts at a local level, and that one's going to be on a Saturday. And then we're looking to do another sort of bigger one in late January to start talking about what we found from the needs assessment. As I mentioned, we've been doing a lot of the phase one work right now in terms of the first round of engagement meetings. We were also finishing up the baseline and needs assessment work right now. We're hoping to have that done by November. And then we'll be moving forward to start identifying and evaluating strategies. That will be most of the winter and spring, and we'll be starting to sort of flesh some of those strategies out, hopefully with you and our technical advisory committees in the January timeframe, just to start getting some input. There's a lot of projects people have already thought of, a lot of strategies that have been considered, but not in a comprehensive way. So we're definitely not starting from scratch with a lot of these ideas. And then by the fall of next year, having a draft goods movement plan out for public review and approval by the end of the year. As I mentioned, we've been doing a lot of meetings with community groups and various stakeholders to talk about some trends, issues, and strategies. And this is just sort of a snapshot of what we've been hearing. We'll have more detailed reports in the next few months on this. But we've heard a lot about, you know, the importance of goods movement for supporting jobs in the region and really making sure that we're keeping pace with economic trends, that we're attracting investors, and that we're capitalizing on that by providing jobs to residents who are most impacted by goods movement. We've heard a lot about the Port of Oakland in terms of improvements in rail service, capitalizing on some opportunities for bulk, both there as well as at our smaller ports. Who have had some steady growth, and trying to look at turn times. There's a lot of issues at the port that sort of spill over into communities in terms of inefficient movements within the port. So we have been talking about a couple of different strategies to address that. Local truck routes comes up a lot. It actually came up in our 2004 goods movement plan as well. The sometimes lack of connectivity between truck routes across jurisdictional boundaries. As well as a lot of issues now with complete streets and conflicts that result in multiple uses of the same streets. So we're going to be doing some case studies, and those case studies will be focused in Alameda County because they're doing the more detailed level of work, but we're trying to identify case studies we think will be really applicable across the region to look at how you balance those needs for the streets. We actually heard from some of the bus operators and bike and ped advocates that it's a really big challenge to have the complete street piece plus trucks. As I mentioned earlier, the community participation in terms of jobs is a really critical thing we've heard a lot about, and that's where we're trying to partner with some of the work coming out of the HUD grant, as well as looking for best practices across the country. And ITS, increasingly our region is pretty built out, so we are trying to look at ways to utilize what we have better in ITS. There's a couple of interesting projects underway across the country that we're going to be monitoring. And, of course, everyone wants to know where the money is going to be coming from for these projects. So funding will be an issue as we start identifying and pricing out strategies. Safety, every transportation plan safety is an issue. But for freight, it's really a multi-mode issue in terms of safety. We've got roadway safety. We also have rail safety and public health and pollution in terms of impacts on just people's general health is a very big issue. Pavement maintenance, we've heard a lot from local jurisdictions about damaged pavement on truck routes, on first and last mile routes that feed freight facilities. And less comments actually about the highway pavement maintenance, much more about the local streets and roads from what we've heard. And then we've also been talking a lot, and we will continue talking to some of the passenger rail providers. Most of our goods movement corridors are also our commute corridors. So you have a lot of mixed-use freeways. You've got trucks and passenger vehicles, and then on the rail network, you have the passenger rail a lot using the freight main line. So there's a lot of conflicts there. And at grade crossings, people are very interested in trying to understand ways to do noise abatement strategies and also try to address congestion concerns at grade crossings. Land use conflicts in industrial corridors. I think some of you might recall back in 2008 we did a study of some of the land use and goods movement conflicts. You know, those have not gone away, and so we're going to be trying to take another look at that. And then truck parking, which is always an issue in local communities that are near freight facilities, in terms of trucks parking in their neighborhoods and idling in their neighborhoods. So this is just a snapshot of some of the issues we'll be looking at. Some strategies that I've already mentioned a little bit in terms of tying them to the strategies are how we can try and improve some of the facilities that we do have in the region, make them more efficient, make sure they're economic centers where we can create jobs, trying to identify some freight ITS projects to advance, trying to look at multimodal corridors. These are primarily interregional corridors, so we are in discussions with our neighboring MPOs about how we can improve some of those corridors. Arterials, that's going to be a big piece of some of the recommendations coming out of the Alameda County plan that we're going to try to, you know, try and take best practices from to apply across the region. Industrial land use, and then we are going to be doing some zero emissions freight technology analysis, which I'll get to in a later slide, but we will be talking about some of that as part of this plan. It'll probably be sort of teeing up some later work, and then bottleneck relief for rail and highways. A few other things just to mention that we'll be wrapping up towards the end of this year is the Caltrans Freight Mobility Plan that I mentioned, as well as the California Air Resources Board is developing a sustainable freight strategy. It's underway right now. They'll actually be doing their public hearing or public workshop next Monday here in this room from 6 to 8 p.m. if people are interested. I'm not sure exactly what they'll be presenting at that meeting, but they will be doing a series of public workshops about what they've been doing for that effort. It's a lot of research on zero emissions and near zero emissions technologies and how ready they are for deployment. So we're hoping to build off of that analysis as we move into some of the zero emissions freight work that will be starting early next year. I think CARB definitely has a lot of the experts in terms of the technology assessments, so we're hoping to be able to use that information. Our next steps will be completing the baseline assessment probably next month and finalizing the needs assessments, moving into strategy development early, beginning part of next year. And as I mentioned, we're doing ongoing stakeholder engagement. The second roundtable, it looks like it's probably going to be in November now just because of some conflicts, but in West Oakland. And we're working to get that set up and publicized as soon as we have a final date. So with that, I'll take any questions.
So, Rich?
I'll ask the question I always ask when this comes up. You can probably guess what it is. I keep reading more articles about the port at La Playa, Mexico. There's actually yesterday an article in the Kansas City Star where the terminus will be for this freight before it's shipped out around the rest of the country, saying there's a shortage of long-haul drivers and they're begging for truck drivers. And I've never heard anything definitively that we've actually studied the impact. And there was at one time a great deal of freight that passed through here for areas east of here. And it's got to have an impact. It's really going to impact L.A.
Yeah, I think L.A. is definitely the, you know, the part that's of the state that's most concerned about the Mexico ports, as well as the Vancouver, the Canadian Prince Rupert ports that have been growing pretty significantly. Most of the goods moving in and out of the Port of Oakland serve a pretty close-by geography for us, so the connections over to Chicago are less important than our connections within our sort of Northern California out to Nevada, maybe Utah sort of range. So there's been a lot of research on it, you know, mainly at sort of the national level that comes out with conflicting responses about how much anyone should worry about it and if it's, you know, that compared to dredging the East Coast ports, you know, what really are the competitive implications for us. So I think we are looking at those. Thankfully, our consultant's very aware of a lot of those and has done a lot of work in LA trying to understand it because they're more likely to see impacts in terms of ships. Most of the ships that come to the Port of Oakland, it's not their first port they hit on the West Coast. They usually go to LA and Long Beach first and then come here and then head back.
You know, this port's not a one-trick pony. They've got long-term plans. They're going to keep enlarging it. And it's probably going to be the most modern port in the country. In the world.
The Mexican port.
I just editorial comment. I did not understand why they're doing what they're doing in the Middle West. Kansas City had the second largest rail yards in the country. They're building a whole new rail yards in suburban. Kansas City Southern has massive rail yards inside the city limits. And yet they're throwing all this money away in concrete, creating more hydrocarbons.
Mike?
Yeah, I was just going to say that I also read something yesterday from the American Railroad Association that many of the railroads in the Midwest and East are also doing that. They're building new yards in Miami and New Orleans, Louisiana, along the Mississippi to catch some of the traffic that will be transferred to barges. Union Pacific has spent $400 million on a new rail yard in New Mexico, which is close proximity to the Mexican border. So the railroads know where the traffic is going to be, and they're investing some of their money, but a lot of the ports are also doing that throughout the Midwest and East, and I'm aware, Rich, of the Kansas City Southern Project as well. So we might be behind the eight ball on this. Thank you.
Finally, somebody else is concerned about it.
I had a question in terms of just to clarifying. Is there any sense of what's making up the bulk of that other category, which is fairly large?
It's a lot of miscellaneous different things. So, unfortunately, it's hard to nail that down. But it's a huge mix of different commodities.
And then, in terms of the pollution, has any of the community outreach so far also touched on noise pollution in addition to particulates?
Yeah, we've actually heard, particularly we met with Contra Costa Health Department. They noted noise. We met out with West Contra Costa, their TAC out there, WICTAC, and noise was actually the first thing they mentioned. And we've heard it from Emeryville. So we've definitely heard noise pollution as a big concern and a lot of interest in quiet zones. So we're going to be trying to look at how we can put together sort of toolkit for how you would go about getting a quiet zone, some information like that to help jurisdictions who want to proceed with things like that.
And then I had one other question. In terms of some of the crossover with the HUD Regional Prosperity Plan, could you give us a little bit more of a sense about the jobs and equity piece and how that's being studied or where that's laying within this?
Yeah, well, we're just now trying to figure out how we're going to advance, some pieces of of this work focused with a workforce development component. I think it's one thing that in our traditional transportation plans we don't really flesh out very well. And I know I'm not sure what the actual title of the report from the HUD grant was that highlighted goods movement as one of the key, workforce development areas of opportunity in the region, but we do think that there's some good ties there, and there's a couple of projects that we're going to try to get some grant funding for that have been led more at the local level, such as in Northern Contra Costa, where they've been doing some work with workforce development. And right now we're just sort of getting our arms around about what's been going on in the region and trying to see how we might be able to advance those. I think some might show up as part of this study, and others might be things that we just try to advance in parallel.
Thank you. Any additional comments? Mike.
Yeah, I know I came in late, but was discussed the amount of money that we're providing for truckers in Oakland to refurbish and retool their engines so that the diesel emissions are not as bad as they have been? I know that a lot of truckers can't afford, I think it's $30,000 per truck to retrofit the engine so that the diesel pollution is negated down about 90% of what it normally comes out of those engines, and also it improves fuel efficiency. Is there a specific amount of money that either through grants or other funding that we can help these truckers?
MTC has not put money into the Clean Truck Program. That's been funded by the Air District and at state level by CARB. We did have one of our climate projects helped fund shore power at the Port of Oakland, so that was the one goods movement project we funded through that program. And I do think one of the conversations we should have when we start developing the strategies is, should MTC be contributing funds to some of these cleaner technology programs? I anticipate that'll be something that's debated as we come up with the strategies.
Okay, so I know that just by driving over there, I know that a lot of truckers are the ones that are still in business often wait long times for loads, and of course their trucks are running during that whole time, and of course there's other problems, so that there's not enough truckers out there as well, and this is something that I think probably needs to be addressed. Thank you.
I was just going to quickly mention the study that Carolyn referenced before is the HUD Regional Economic Prosperity Plan study that was done by SPUR in coordination with a number of other organizations. And we'll be bringing back some of the HUD grant deliverables and products to this committee later in the year. So it's a stay tuned item.
Thank you, Ken. All right. Seeing no additional questions or comments, we'll wrap it up. Thank you for your time. So we'll move next to agenda item 6, the countywide transportation plan guidelines, and receive an update from Adam Nolting.
Good afternoon. Adam Nolting with the planning section. I wanted to provide an update for the guidelines for countywide transportation plans. In July, staff presented proposed major changes to the guidelines, which were last updated in year 2000. And so today we will present the update since then to the revised guidelines. Some general background: as previously noted, the original guidelines were drafted in 1989, were last updated in 2000, and has led to today's revision to the guidelines. State law does indicate the content of the CTPs, or the countywide transportation plans, and does require the guidelines. As noted on the slide, the CTPs are intended to be the primary basis for our regional plan, and they're intended to be developed with participation from the cities and transit operators. One of the key components or elements from the countywide transportation plans is the recommended projects that are essentially included or discussed for inclusion in our regional transportation plan. The following graphic is just to give you an idea of kind of the universe of planning. I realize the text isn't showing up as well in the blue, but just to give you an idea of really the intent of this is that there are two different really major pieces going on. We have the county planning efforts, and a lot of their different work plans, modal plans, and other elements really influencing and informing their CTP guide our documents. And in turn, we have the regional plan, which is very similar with our other elements that would inform that plan. And in between, we have the guidelines that kind of go back and forth. And one of the key things we've discussed throughout this update process is that the guidelines and the planning efforts really need to be an iterative process. The plan should our regional plan should help inform countywide plans, and the countywide plans then in turn inform our regional plan. So that is really one of the main things we focused on during the update, and what this graphic is really trying to represent. In general, one of the intents, I guess the three intents we identified for our CTP guidelines, the first being that it should inform the relationship between the plan and the CTPs. We are trying to recognize both the local needs as well as the regional priorities. It's also, the guidelines are intended to assist implementation of SB 375 and MAP 21, our two other regulating documents and laws essentially for our regional plan. And also, finally, for the CTP guidelines, we want to identify the appropriate content for the counties to include in their documents. The one main thing I wanted to focus on this morning is our update process, as well as the major changes that we are presenting moving forward. In April, we presented to our MTC Planning Committee a schedule for the update process. And then in June, we began collecting information from the counties to get a survey of their existing countywide planning efforts. We presented that survey result, those survey results, to the at a workshop in July. The workshop participants were members of the Regional Advisory Working Group and the Partnership Technical Advisory Committee, which is about, I think, 700 or so individuals, and we had 30 or 40 attendees at each meeting. The first workshop, we focused on reviewing the existing guidelines, and then we opened it up for discussion in small groups to talk about what potential changes we could include moving forward. In July, we presented to the Policy Advisory Council, your committee, a summary of changes that we had proposed for the revised guidelines, and then we moved forward with those comments to develop a revised draft guidelines. Which were then presented in July at a second public workshop. Between all the comments we received throughout the process, as well as written comments we received, we've arrived at our revised guidelines, which is included in your packet of materials as attachment A. Throughout the process, we did receive two main themes. The first one being that there is an interest for the plans to be consistent with Plan Bay Area and its numerous elements of the plan, including targets, equity framework, and public participation. Another theme was that the guidelines should be flexible and allow the counties to reflect local priorities and stimulate innovation among within their counties. These are just a couple of examples of quotes we received through the comment letters. Included in July, as well as in attachment B of your materials, we presented a summary of changes. This was based on the existing guidelines to where we got through the input into today's meeting. What we've updated in this material is essentially we've highlighted and identified or underlined new content since the July version that we presented to you. This goes through all the different elements, including different topic areas, outreach, performance, investments, equity, and others. So I wanted to highlight the fact that we did present this in July, but we wanted to make sure you were aware that the additional and changes to that document have been highlighted in underlying text. I think some of the three things I wanted to really focus on at this point for the updated guidelines then would be that based on the input and from Workshop 2 and the comment letters we received, we did make additional references to Plan Bay Area throughout the document. That was one of the findings and discussion points during the workshops as well as the comment letters. And also we're recommending that and encouraging the counties to partner with MTC throughout their development of their CTPs. We also wanted to identify a number of resources throughout the document where counties could look to different elements of work that MTC staff has done or other elements out there that they could reference for examples of best practice and other types of things like that. Kind of focusing back on the Plan Bay Area linkage, one of the things we really wanted to, we added based on some of the comments was the adding references to the planning context. Essentially, we're giving more information about what's going on with SB 7375, how we arrived at Plan Bay Area. So it gives a more broad overview of the planning process. In addition, we added some more information about performance. As previously noted, there was an interest for more linkage to Plan Bay Area's performance measures. So one of the things we wanted to add to our revised guidelines is an appendix that has a list of the actual performance targets in Plan Bay Area. Similarly, with public participation, there was certainly an interest to have a more robust discussion about the public participation process. So in turn, we added a link to our public participation plan as well as the outreach efforts. Finally, I guess I would focus on the last piece is really going at the effective date. We are proposing that the guidelines be in effect for CTPs initiated after October 1st, and this would be consistent with federal and other state rulemaking activities. And after that, I guess I would open it up for any questions.
I see none immediately. Are there any clarifying questions? Oh, Bob Glover?
Yeah, maybe more of a comment than I have less of a question, more of a comment. So I'll hold off on that if you want me to wait.
Go right ahead.
All right. I appreciate the report, and I sympathize with you on the competing interests because I think as I've been a part of that. There was a letter that was submitted today on behalf of the Bay Area Business Coalition that made some additional amendments. I just want to focus on two of those. I think the key two ones. One is, you know, as we look at this throughout this process and throughout the updates that we've received, this is these are voluntary guidelines. And I think the one thing from the Bay Area the Business Coalition is creating some clarifying language. And so one of those recommendations is that it clarify in there that, you know, first that CMA receipt of funding from MTC is not conditioned upon adherence to these guidelines specifically. And then the second one has to do with what you talked about with the reference to Plan Bay Area and specifically the performance targets. And one of the requests from the business community is that those performance targets be included in the document, which it sounds like they are, and more of a clarification as to what those are and what they aren't. I think there's a concern from many in the business community that the language as currently drafted could be used to undermine local projects, undermine the will of local voters that have approved specific funding, local tax measures, different things, to prohibit those from getting funding from MTC or additional funding. And so those things speak to that, those two items. And so I think you've done a marvelous job. We would just respectfully request that those two items be clarified in there. I really think they're just clarifying language. I don't think we're really objecting to anything else that's included in the document. So yeah, that's all I've got.
Rich Hedges?
Yeah, this is just sort of in the same context. I was just curious. On Section B of the introduction, it talks about the countywide transportation plans are on a voluntary basis. Are there any counties that don't do it?
Currently, 7 of the 9 counties have adopted a plan or are currently adopting a new plan, a revised plan. There is one that is several years old, and then there is another county that does not have a current plan. Marin County. I do not have an answer for that, no.
Maybe they're waiting for SMART to start and see what happens after that.
I really appreciate the emphasis and some of the modified language specifying public outreach rather than stakeholder outreach, which has some pretty interesting interpretations sometimes. And again, just added specificity about who you'd expect them to have at the table. I would be curious, given Bob's comment around the Bay Area Business Coalition, although these are guidelines, some of the requirements of the Plan Bay Area funding under the One Bay Area grant do make certain things required, effectively. Certain land use policies and complete streets policies, for example. Can you kind of walk across how that carrot can be used as it would relate to kind of the updated CTP guidelines?
That isn't something that we discussed during the guideline process. We do recognize that they are guidelines, and the CTPs themselves are voluntary, so we did not discuss any sort of carrot or stick in the process.
That's understandable, since those were also more city-level requirements, yeah. Not county. That's appropriate. So, and I'm sorry, do you have a date yet for the upcoming workshop? I think I may have overlooked it.
Actually, the workshops are complete at this point. What we will be doing is presenting the revised draft, Attachment A, to the Planning Committee this Friday. Then it will be moving forward based on their discussion.
Any additional comments or questions in regards to the CTP guidelines? All right, seeing none, we will actually, rather than being moving on to our, thank you, Alex, or Adam, sorry, rather than moving on to our next agenda item number 7 and 8, since staff is still on their way down, we'd like to move on to agenda item 9, the staff liaison report at this point in time.
Well, thank you. I thought I would just go over my report since Rebecca is on her way down. Rebecca's going to be filling in for Randy, who had another meeting that he got stuck in and couldn't make it. So if you look at my staff report, I just wanted to reiterate that we are in a recruitment phase for 3 vacancies on this advisory body in Marin, Santa Clara, and San Mateo County. And would certainly appreciate your assistance if you know of any local agencies that you'd like us to reach out to, or any individuals that you could forward the information to. I'd be happy to also send information out to individuals as well. You can just point them in the direction of our website. The information's up there. But the deadline for applications is October 1st, so a couple weeks left on that. Appreciate your help there. Also, if you look over on the table, we have a new map available of the region, a Plan Bay Area map. I remember when I first started working here back in 1997, I was struck by the map of the Bay Area and how cool that was. Well, we have an updated one available. It's available for you to take and rolled up over there today. And if you know of people that are interested in getting one, they can order one through our MTC ABAG library. And that information's in here for you as well. And if you haven't had a chance to get to one of the Experience Electric events, there are a few that are left, and I've outlined those in here for you. Get to one of those. You can actually drive an electric vehicle and experience that for yourself and see how cool they are and how close they are to, I understand, not that far off from a regular vehicle. So I will be trying that out myself. I think Jerry has. Jerry.
Question. I notice here that the third position in Napa, has that been filled?
Did I say Napa?
No, you didn't.
No, but you should have. That's what we're asking.
Did I say Napa? It's Marin. Marin,
yes,
Santa Clara.
That is correct, but we lost Jack.
Well, so here's what happened. The reason we have an opening, I should clarify that. The reason we have an opening in San Mateo is because in July, the chair and the vice chair of the commission appointed Kathleen Baker, your chair, to the vacancy position in Napa. Kathleen Baker, your chair, moved. She resigned her day job in San Mateo, and she moved to Napa. So Kathleen now no longer lives in San Mateo. She lives in Napa. So yes. Just in time. We were joking earlier that she may have been the cause of the earthquake. It was a big move to Napa.
Yeah, we'd be happy if this morning's paper showed $80 million in damage, so we'd be happy if you wanted to write a check and cover that.
Get right on that.
So at the point that she was appointed to the position, the at-large, and it was actually an at-large position. It wasn't a Napa position. It was an at-large position. That made her position in San Mateo a vacancy, a low-income position vacancy in San Mateo. So the three vacancies are now Marin, Santa Clara, and San Mateo. So, and that's part of the reason we waited on the vacancy recruitment to see if they would, in fact, make that appointment, which they did. So that's all I have.
Thank you. And I would recommend everybody check out the maps, even if they're not going to take them with them. It was some really fantastic work by MTC staff. So with that, thank you, Pam. And we'll go back to agenda item 7, the Air Resources Board guidance regarding cap and trade funding for disadvantaged communities. And we'll hear from Rebecca Long. And I did, as we go into that, I did want to thank several of the Policy Advisory Council members who we know turned out at the meeting last Wednesday. I saw several faces there, so thank you to everybody who came out.
That's what I was going to say. Hi, Rebecca Long, MTC staff. Yeah, it was great to see so many of you there, so thank you for that. And for your interest in this issue. I actually also sent Pam a sample letter this afternoon that maybe she can circulate so that, you know, you guys can submit letters of your own, and the comments are due next Monday. And she'll have a web link on where to send those comments to. So this item is really kind of the second piece of this whole disadvantaged communities question, and comments are due on this as well. Next Monday, as well as, you know, this whole issue we've been talking more about, which is how do you define disadvantaged communities? So this is the question of how do the state agencies that are administering these different grants, how do they determine, you know, when they evaluate a project that comes in, whether it provides a benefit to a disadvantaged community? So it's a It's a larger document, but the most relevant pieces we excerpted for the for your agenda, and it's I'm just going to be sort of talking about pages 1-1 and 1-2 that look like this. And basically, I don't know if people have had a chance to look it over. I won't go through all the details. But the first part is they talk about, well, how do you define whether a project is located in a disadvantaged community? That seems fairly straightforward. You know, if it's a bus stop, it's either in or out. But they talk about some other pieces that I don't really want us to focus on today. I think the more important question in terms of you know, how it could impact the Bay Area and how our projects fare is on the benefit, because the targets are much higher for the amount of funds that have to benefit a disadvantaged community. So just as a reminder, for the transit formula funding, 50% of funds that an operator receives have to benefit a disadvantaged community if they have one in their service area. So, for example, BART. BART does have disadvantaged communities, even under the criteria we don't like. It does have some in their service area. They have to make sure that 50% of the money they get go to benefit at least one of those communities. If you don't have a disadvantaged community, then you don't have to worry about it. So that's kind of ironic. But that's how that works. And so the page 1-1 talks about with transit, you know, how would you define it? And they talk about for local bus service, you know, it needs to improve the service for riders using stations or stops within a half a mile of a disadvantaged community. But for more commuter bus or for rail, they talk about service improvements within a zip code that contains the disadvantaged community. And they describe, you know, different types of things. So I'm looking at this letter C. So it provides improved intercity rail service for riders using stations or stops. The next one is it improves connectivity for riders using stations or stops. So it might include bike racks on rail or better links between local bus. Anyway, it gets quite technical, but I just wanted folks to, if they did have any reactions to this, to let us know, because we're certainly under the gun to put together and finalize our comments. One thing that we're looking closely at is the use of zip code. It's kind of arbitrary, really doesn't have any relationship to transportation. On the other hand, you know, it can be a relatively wide geography, so, you know, I think while in some ways we're considering recommending against zip code and recommending instead a geographic buffer, like maybe a mile, we're not sure that's necessarily in the best interest of the region if zip code, in fact, covers a lot more areas, right? So we're mapping that right now and looking into that. The other piece is that they don't mention anything to do with rolling stock. And as you might recall, that being rail vehicles or buses, it strictly talks about service improvements. And, you know, while we absolutely understand that, you know, service improvements are a priority, we do think that if you're replacing your vehicle stock, your aging, you know, rail cars or buses, that does provide a benefit to the riders, because you want to have equipment that's well maintained and it's not breaking down. And so I think that's one of the recommendations that we would make, as well as to expand the eligibility to also include transit vehicles. And then on the affordable housing piece, one thing that really caught our eye, it's a little bit strange the way they organize this. They say it's just by project type and not program. So, you know, the transit or the sort of the project types. But then for the affordable housing and sustainable communities piece, the only thing they talk about really are housing projects. Even though there's many, many types of projects that are eligible for that program. There's bicycle and pedestrian, standalone projects that are eligible, transit projects are eligible. Essentially anything that implements the SCS is eligible in the statute. And so that's something we'll be pointing out and saying, you know, wait a minute, this is too narrow in terms of your definition of what could benefit from this program. We also have been having some discussions and have some concern about the limitation of affordable housing projects to within a half a mile of the disadvantaged community, because to us, you know, providing an affordable housing project that might not necessarily be located in a disadvantaged community certainly could benefit current residents of a disadvantaged community who might want to move there or have, you know, better access, closer access to their jobs. So I think that's kind of another interesting policy question that we're grappling with. And I'll leave it there and see if folks have any comments or questions.
Alan?
It seems that zip code, and maybe you've already stated this, for considering that a disadvantaged community doesn't take into account the micro nature of so many disadvantaged communities, and it would leave a lot out in the averaging. Mm-hmm. How do you deal with that?
What they're talking about here is they're saying if you have a disadvantaged community that's been identified by the state, then if a project is within that zip code, it would benefit that disadvantaged community. So I don't think it's not a concern that they would leave disadvantaged communities out. It's a question of would they be drawing the geography in a rational way? And I mean, just to make a, you know, kind of crude example, you can imagine a project, you know, that's just on the edge of a different zip code, even though it's within a half a mile of a disadvantaged community, or let's say it's within 3/4 of a mile, so it doesn't fit the half a mile definition, not in the same zip code, so it doesn't benefit, right? So that's why we're thinking, well, maybe it's better to stick with a distance-based buffer, like a mile, or maybe it should be a mile and a half, you know. So we're talking to our planners, trying to get the best practices, you know, in the literature. And it does seem like a mile, you know, after all, we're talking about low-income people who probably aren't accessing the transit by car, and a mile is about a 15-minute walk, and blah, blah, blah. So, but that's, I hope that, does that answer your question?
I think you make a very good point. If you have a disadvantaged community 2 miles from the rail, and you want to build a project next to the tracks so that disadvantaged people could use it, they can't take advantage of the funding under that mm-hmm. norm.
Right.
Or if they're outside of the zip code.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So, Randy and then Rich.
So, I just want everybody here to understand that their definition of disadvantaged communities does not correlate with either the care communities or our equity analysis communities that are disadvantaged, our communities of concern. So we had considerable pushback at that meeting because their formula doesn't work for us. It doesn't address the communities that we've spent years identifying, and that's a huge concern to me. So no matter which way they tweak it, and I sat at a second table where they said, well, maybe we'll use the zip code thing because then if we use the zip code, then you can retrofit a truck that affects, you know, in Oakland, which, by the way, that area doesn't fall under their guidelines. And it will benefit because it falls within the zip code of one of their identified communities. Hunter's Point was not on their map. There were just huge numbers of gaps there. So I have big issues with their formulas, and their formulas are not going to be applied the same for, if I understood that correctly at the table that Carlos and I were at. So you have all these people getting money, and they don't have to apply the formula the same way. And there doesn't have to be any competition. I mean, there is competition across the state for the pots of money with no criteria as to. So the formulas themselves were just really just crazy to me. But I would like to see if you are actually mapping that, how that affects the communities that we deal with, whether it's via zip code mapping, if you use zip code as the guideline or you use a 1 mile boundary and extend mm-hmm. their half mile boundary mm-hmm. as a guideline, mm-hmm. because we've got to be able to advocate one way or the other. And right now, I was just really disappointed with what I saw there, because I didn't see some of our most needy communities being eligible for money.
Mm-hmm. Right. If I could respond, you know, there really are two pieces of this, as you know. There's the definition of the disadvantaged communities, and then there's this question of how do you define benefit. And we, you know, continue to take issue with their proposed definition, the Kallenbeier screen method one. And we're continuing to, you know, make that point, and we're offering this alternative that the Bay Area Air District has helped put together that is much, much better for the region, that it encompasses, you know, many more, about 75% of our communities of concern. So it's much better. But we still need to answer this question of, you know, how, where do you draw the boundary? And so we're trying to, you know, answer it with integrity, just on its face, but also look at, okay, if they go with their definition, you know, is it better for us to stick with zip code, or is it better for us to go with a 1 mile or something like that?
Rich, and then Carlos.
I'm just a little bit troubled by I was a little troubled by the whole process. It seems to me that outlining communities and saying this is where we're going to do most of the work makes some sense, but I think we need to see where the jobs are. If we're going to make an impact on air and on where people and how people live, we need to be, especially when it comes to affordable or below market rate housing, looking at where the jobs are. An anecdotal example, as a member, actually on the executive board of an organization that is called Housing Leadership Council, and doing fundraising, I went to Home Depot to talk to the manager there about doing a grant. And the gatekeeper for grants, when I told her what I was doing, has a Section 8 grant for a 3-bedroom apartment, drives from the East Bay, and can find nothing in the West Bay that will accept that. She terribly wants to get into the West Bay, not in the community of concern where she comes from, because that's where she works, and that's where she wants her kids to go to school. So I understand the methods we're using, but it may not solve the problem.
So I also had, and I'm not going to belabor the point Rebecca and Randy have made about the concern with the definition of a disadvantaged community. I guess the question or the thoughts that I had are, and I guess thinking about it maybe the way that the ones who came up with the guidelines were, they're looking at reducing greenhouse gas emissions versus trying to solve kind of all the, you know, disadvantaged minority. Because that's the one thing, is that this is really, it's not just low income. It has all these other factors that go into it about, you know, brownfields and air pollution and all that. So I still have a real issue with the definition of what they came up with. But if we're really trying to improve the qualities of those particular neighborhoods, then it should be targeted to those neighborhoods. We should find, so that's the way I look at it, and I think the more you expand it, the more you dilute it. Really, it's those. I do agree that they should have a more robust, I mean, the Bay Area just got completely shifted out of this. I mean, it's just, and the fact that other without, I was going to try not to do this, but, you know, it's like a lot of those communities are in very, it's like the Central Valley, where do we really want to shift our population to the Central Valley? Is that kind of like, do we want to start building affordable housing in those high-need census tracts that they did? It's just a thought, and you should look at the maps, because it's really stark, what's happened here in the Bay Area and how we've just been. Anyway, but so I was trying to put it myself into that thought process, is that this is really more about trying to improve the conditions in those particular neighborhoods. And so it dilutes it when you go further out. And I guess on the affordable housing, sustainable communities part, I understand, you know, that it should be a little more broad than just affordable housing. I think that thinking about employment centers and walkability, I don't know if that's in the other, if it's in this other 60%. I mean, pedestrians and other kinds of should be included in not just, you know, having vehicles.
But that should be part of it. And then, you know, I do think that affordable housing is a major component to this, and so I do want to make sure that does get its ability to get some money for that too.
Randy, other question?
I guess my question is, and Carlos is right. If you look at their maps, there's this huge discrepancy because it's a list of criteria, and it's this and this and this and this and this. So I guess my question is, how do we influence the criteria when it comes to actually getting the money? Because the first thing that they said at that meeting was, which, by the way, for those of you who didn't attend it, started 30 minutes late and was the worst run meeting I've ever attended, which says a lot. But how do we make – they said from the beginning, we want this program to get the most bang for the buck. And I couldn't see any way for them getting – serving the most people for each dollar that gets spent. So how do we influence that as a region, or can we?
You know, I think our best bet at influencing that is to persuade them to use a different approach to defining the communities. So, again, you know, Method 6 is much more favorable towards metropolitan areas where most of the people live. And, you know, to the extent that then those jurisdictions apply for the funding and have good projects that are located in disadvantaged communities, they'll have a decent shot. But, you know, if we have so few communities in those metro areas that would have the cost-effective projects, then chances are, you know, they won't get funded. So it really does come back to the definition.
So, and I just, maybe because you understand this technically better than I do, the way I saw it was a community that's out in the Central Valley would actually get a higher rating to obtain, say, affordable housing dollars or retrofitting or any of those things based on its color on their maps than a community further in. So my concern is that we would actually be encouraging more housing to be built in a community that creates longer commute times for the very people that we're trying. So am I reading that correctly?
I think you are. I mean, I would make a little nuance on it, and that is that there are targets, right, that the different agencies have for the share of funds that have to go to disadvantaged communities. So they, when they look at all these projects, they have to meet, for example, for the affordable housing, sustainable communities, 50% of that money overall needs to benefit those communities. For the other projects, once they've met that quota, you know, we don't know exactly how they're going to approach it. There is language that says they should maximize the amount of funding going to disadvantaged communities. But, you know, for the other projects, maybe that won't be a factor. They're not, you know, in the law, they're not bound to, in their criteria, say, and give any project located in a disadvantaged community a head up. But they have to meet, you know, that threshold. So I think it's generally fair.
Sure. One clarification from Pam, and then we'll go to Chris.
Just to Randy's point, I know Rebecca is actually presenting on a different item, but to Randy's point, Rebecca did forward this letter to me that I can send out to all of you that just gives you some sample language that you can send out that does advocate on behalf of Method 6 that you can forward. It tells you where to send it, and it gives you some sample language to say, and I'll forward that to all of you. So look for that to come in an email probably tomorrow.
Thank you very much. Chris?
I'm just curious about what kind of response you've received, if any, when you bring these inconsistencies to their attention.
So our table, when we brought these discrepancies up, was chastised by the moderator for bringing up a question that needed to be brought up in the other room. And that was to me, and so then we had to stop and parse out whether everybody was going to share this information with everybody participating. So from somebody who participated, that was the feedback that we got.
I think that was universally the experience at the workshop. There have been, you know, higher level meetings that have been going on, you know, with staff, both from MTC and the Air District, with staff at Cal EPA. And I think, you know, one of the problems is that they have been working on this methodology for a number of years. They actually developed it before, you know, the cap and trade legislation on this subject was enacted. So they're very invested in it. But I think they understand, you know, that the concern, particularly when you look at the fact that cost of living, you know, isn't adjusted for, and the fact that, you know, many low income communities are excluded. But I think, you know, to Carlos's point, where they were coming from originally in mapping these areas was to really find what are the areas in the state that have cumulative, you know, impacts. And that's a question, you know, worth answering. I think our point is that particular way of drawing the map isn't necessarily the most appropriate when you're talking about where to invest transportation and housing funds from cap and trade. So, you know, Method 6 is not throwing out, you know, all the work that they've done. We're actually using the same variables for the most part. It's just a different configuration. Maybe the simplest way to characterize it, as Randy was saying, you know, they look at it as and with every 19 of the variables. This is more like, you know, this or this and this or this. So it allows for a community that might have five characteristics, poor air quality, low income, et cetera, to still be counted, even if you don't measure up on some of the others.
I understand that we're a long way into that, into their process, but remind us regarding this letter what the deadline is for comment.
It's next Monday.
It's on a rather fast track. Another element that I did want to share, what kind of came up in our conversations at some of our tables, was also the notion that outside of the specific program to be administered by the Strategic Growth Council, these dollars are flowing through several other programs as well. So really looking at how are we going to hold those other programs accountable and those other jurisdictions receiving those dollars for expending them in an equitable and effective and fashion so that we are getting the most bang for that buck. And I think some of what Rebecca was speaking to in terms of Method 6 and the recommendations in the letter is that it really goes more to the spirit and the actual language in the legislation around the cap and trade revenue that really makes it more of an and or, you know, these select metrics of communities can be disadvantaged based on socioeconomic factors as well as environmental factors, both of which still have a nexus with greenhouse gas emissions. So it really, I think some of the Cal Enviro screen work, while it's fantastic work and a lot of really good brains went into it, it doesn't build on the or. It's really an and that's, it's missing the mark.
All right, I think Randy...
One more question. Is there anything built into this for an automatic review? Because they're talking about we're giving the money to these groups, and they're going to start figuring out how to spend the money. But my concern was, is there, and I couldn't find anybody who could answer this, is there a method for, say, 2 years from now, we come back and say, these are the communities that were served. This is what the project, because if I know that that's built in, I know I have a timer on that I can come back to them with, and I'm not going to worry so much about today, but I'm going to worry about that in 2 years and build that data. Is that built into this at all?
Their materials have, you know, indicated that this will be updated, that the methodology for, you know, defining the communities will be updated with new information, et cetera. So I would definitely expect that that will occur. I mean, I think the legislature will demand it. I think there's just too much money and too many different agencies administering this to not have some overarching review. So, you know, I would expect that. I think you know, to your point, it is just 1 year initially, but we just want to try to get it as right as we can the first time so that we don't have to make such a large correction going forward. But I would expect, you know, we'll have a chance to, A, review and update.
There is a review, but I think that's even more important as we consider that just in this first year, that's just a very small slice of the revenue that's going to be coming down. So this is going to be a much bigger pot of money to get wrong in future years. So it is right to get it correct now. All right, I don't see any more comments or questions, but so Pam will be sending out the letter template tomorrow, and I would really encourage anyone that has the time or interest to submit their comments to the state. We'll try to make it as easy as possible. So with that, we will move to item 8, legislative update, which I believe Randy and Rebecca will present together. Or
Randy, we shall. Although I want to see the movie Method 6. I mean, I think I know my teenage boy can't wait for that. how we come up with things. So, you know, one of the best parts of us coming down here and talking to you is to get some advice from you and some direction. And we try to do that on the legislative side, at least in the fall of each year. And we'll be back in the next couple of months to get your thoughts about what you think we ought to do in Sacramento. And these few slides I'm going to show you gets to some ideas that we are knocking around, or at least some ideas about revenue in the state of California, and also to give you some context. So I think this first slide gives you a sense that a lot of the action is here locally in the Bay Area. We're grateful that we have both voters willing to approve things, and not every place across the state has that, but also the economic wherewithal in order to do it. On the next slide, what you can see is get a sense of the scale of how much money goes into things. And I want to bring to your attention those first three bars. Not completely, but most of that money is going toward public transit, local streets and roads repair, if you include the fourth one, for sure. And also can give you a sense of the amount of money that's raised. And again, you can see the importance of local sales taxes in the Bay Area to make things work. We do have a bit of a new landscape with respect to trying to raise funds. You know, in the state of California, we've been on this march now since the early 1970s to make it harder and harder and harder for the citizenry to vote for things, and we've continued that with Prop 26. So essentially things that were once considered fees, such as a vehicle reg fee, for an example, can only be spent in a very certain way, or everything subject to a vote. What we're here considering is some new revenue options that the commission may or may not take an action on. To give you a sense of the scale here, you know, the state generally puts a gas tax on, although the commission does have the authority to place a regional gas tax on the ballot. The polling doesn't look so great. The counties have the ability to and have succeeded in putting half-cent sales taxes on. That's generally something that we haven't done regionally. And then there's a few things that kind of hit that gray space about, well, should we consider this or that? Here's a few vehicle-based revenue options. Part of this is just to inform you. You can get a sense of the scale. A vehicle license fee exists in California. It was reduced, as you may recall, by Governor both Davis and did Schwarzenegger do that? Davis probably fell on the sword for it, but that's what I thought. Right, that's right. See, I knew someone would remember that. Yeah, yeah. Rich, I'm glad you're older than me, because I think other than a history lesson, look, the important thing is the scale of revenue difference. Reg fee is on your it's like a dollar version on a plate on a vehicle. Excuse me, that's what runs the tow trucks and the call boxes on the freeways. But you need a big annual reg fee to generate significant money. As you know, the Bay Area is working to put express lanes around the Bay Area. The goal of these things isn't to raise funds. The goal of these things is to connect the system together on the revenue part and investment part, and also to rationalize transportation choice to allow people to make decisions, in this case, to pay to get out of the traffic jam. Bridge tolls, you can see in this case $1 if we were to propose a regional measure 3. For those of you whose history is not as good as Rich's, there has been a regional measure 1 in 1988 and a regional measure 2 in 2004. And this would be a theoretical future one, and you can get a sense of the vote requirement. A road user charge is also known as a VMT. That's kind of a theoretical idea. We're going to get to some points later about what the state's doing, but that gives you a sense of what the scale could raise if you were to impose it on a half cent per mile. There are payroll taxes in a couple of places around the country of which they use for transportation. You can see that they can raise some significant money with not a whole lot of large percentage of a tax on it. There's also transportation utility taxes that you see. Most of these are in Oregon, not all. And there's the idea of a regional developer fee as well. These things tend to be local. They emerge in Contra Costa County and housing developments in Solano County as well to try to deal with the traffic effects that these housing developments have on existing facilities. One issue is equity, and equity is often thrown around by all sides, usually making the argument to most, you know, benefit themselves. But in this case is how does it affect people on income level as opposed to how does it affect them on investment levels? So if you raise a tax that can affect people income-wise, it can be disproportionate beneficial on another group depending on how you use the money. So in this case, just because regional gas taxes would not be progressive in any form and everyone would pay the same, you would see that it has a high impact on folks with low-income budgets. On the other scale, on that top line, vehicle license fee, again, as an example, what you tend to see in the data is people with means tend to have not just more vehicles, but they tend to have vehicles that cost more. And so you can begin to see a little discrepancy on the side of who pays. This is kind of all those revenue options laid out on one page, so you can just, again, see relatively to each other what can raise the most. And what you pay a lot of penalty for politically but don't get very much for it. That is best described by that, like a dollar reg fee. It just doesn't raise very much. In this case, I think that's a $10 fee there. Is that it? So in any event, we here in the commission has not yet made a determination if they want to go to Sacramento and seek additional funds at all. But In your discussions amongst yourselves and others, when you kind of deal with how do we fix the problems we're complaining about, you know, for example, today I think you may have seen in Mateer and Ross, if you read the newspaper, the griping about the BART system and how there's just no place to get on anymore. You know, the roads are getting more congested. For those of you who will follow this, we are essentially at the employment levels in the Bay Area that we were during the dot-com boom, the highest of the boom. So the August numbers have not come out yet from the state, but we're within 0.5% in July of the top peak. And everyone remembers all that congestion and all those stories. And, you know, the Sunil grade went from like the 30th most congested to the second most congested in a short period of time. So I think this conversation is going to pick up. The last time the state of California collectively did something was when Governor Schwarzenegger did that $20 billion bond, which, Rich, do you remember that year? It was not yesterday. It was almost 10 years ago, 2006. There hasn't been a meaningful change in Washington, D.C. or in the state to deal with this economic growth that we're facing. And the consequence we face for not paying is that we pay in congestion. We pay in BART being crowded. The other challenge facing us, just to be the dire person today, is the system our parents built for us is breaking down. There's the streets and roads were built for us. They're wearing out. All that post-war boom is going away. BART is not young anymore. And although we had a great year this past year in the legislature with cap and trade for our subject transportation, remember, we didn't have to necessarily be assigned those funds. I think it's important that we understand that society will continue to challenge us, and we're here to get your opinion on things as you see fit. So that's kind of really all we wanted to do.
Of course.
Alan, go ahead and start us off.
Alan's going to beat a dead horse.
Revenue generation.
Everyone hears about the fracking, and everyone hears about the tarring of fuel and how much it cost and possible downside. And no one in this state seems to want to think that every other fuel-producing state in the country or energy-producing state in the country has a fuel extraction tax. And the fuel companies, every time we come out and we say we want it or we go to vote on it, tell us our prices are going to go up. We have the highest fuel prices in the country already. An awful lot of our fuel is exported anyway to other countries, and we buy fuel from the Middle West. There is a powerhouse that comes out and spends $250 million every time we talk about starting a fuel extraction tax, which is really, really a non-cost, non-tax way to do it, a fuel extraction fee. And everyone's afraid to go after them. But the way to go after them is to go through a program and a strategy that educates the public as to what that means, how we're being ripped off as a state, not getting that, and the fuel companies are winning. Now, what the hell are we doing? What are we thinking?
Alan, if I could ask you, you seem to be informed about this, but in other states where this does occur, do those funds stay, let's say, in the case that we're interested in, into the transportation realm?
In Louisiana, a lot of them go into transportation. Yeah. In Alaska, part of it goes into their highway system, mm-hmm. and their transportation system. Another part of those funds are distributed to the public, right. And everyone gets a $1,200 a year
right.
amount. Louisiana lives very well on that money. If it wasn't for that, Louisiana would be totally broke, and they're broke already. That we don't get it is amazing. There's a tax in even Texas.
Even Mississippi, huh?
probably Mississippi too. It's amazing. We seem to be afraid because I keep bringing this up, and people keep saying, "Well, you can never get it by the fuel companies." Well, yeah. If we keep saying that, it'll never get by the fuel companies because they're the boogeymen. But if we advertise, if we spend money, if we take care, there's a lot of things that money could go towards. I think the last estimate, and I might be misinformed on this, but the last estimate of what they thought a reasonable energy extraction tax would be close to $7 or $8 billion a year. Not much. And the other side of that coin is now there's a big thing on fracking and taking more energy out of the ground. Well, you know, we've always fracked. We've been fracking since the beginning. The only way to get oil out of the ground without a lot of pressure is putting pressure in, and that's fracking. I don't care if we call it a fracking tax and let them frack. But the point is we should be dealing with this. Anyway, that's my speech for today.
Rich and then Mike.
You didn't know I was going to say that.
Yeah, I did know you were going to say it, because you and I always say it. It seems to me that coming from what's considered by Californians a low-tax state, Kansas, when I was a kid, I had a six-year-old car when I was 16, and I paid, not in relative terms, but in actual money, more for my registration in 1957 than I pay now here in California for a six-year-old automobile. The sales tax in Kansas is actually higher than it is here. It's on food. You have your car. You know, California is, in all intents and purposes, for the average person, not a tremendously high tax state compared to other states. And so we have that reputation, and so people get so turned off by any idea that we raise revenue because of that, it becomes difficult. About 2 years ago, I have a NORAD channel on one of my radios. I got caught in a cluster of tornadoes in Kansas.
So I'm listening to the NORAD station and going through all of these little two-lane roads. They're all paved, they're all smooth, but they have a higher gas tax and a really, really high registration fee. So it all depends on what you pay for. And by the way, nobody minds it there because that's how they get their food to market, is through those smooth roads.
Okay, somebody can correct me if I'm wrong, Rich or yourself, but one of the things I think we got into this mess, if I recall, is that Schwarzenegger and some other governor that I can't remember raided those taxes from DMV and registration and other places that was supposed to go to transportation and put it in the general fund. So in the last 10 or 15 years, we have fallen further behind in terms of the amount of money that we had available to do the work in the first place, just to get us up to a state of good repair. And there's nothing that we have that says that can't happen again down the road 10 to 15 years and be in the same place. I mean, the fact that this money is supposed to go someplace and is taken out and put into the general fund. So no matter what we do, there's still a possibility that we can either be further behind the eight ball financially, and that's one hole that needs to be plugged, that money stays there and goes for transportation. Thank you.
Thank you.
Randy, if I could just answer that question real quick. So, you know, Mike, it's an interesting point you make, and I think it's widely held. Because I do think that the general fund has made raiding other funds kind of a regular thing that they do, either borrowing from the schools or from themselves. What I would want to tell you is that in that fight, if you wish to look at it that way, or a game, look, both sides are playing offense and defense. On the transportation side, we probably got the biggest of that. We got the best return on that deal, just to give you a sense. You know, the sales tax on gasoline for forever in this state was considered just like the sales tax on a refrigerator or the resales tax on anything else. It was a general fund item. And so now the sales tax comes to transportation. Ironically, it was a Republican idea that the Democrats stole. Now the Democrats then, you know, or the state of California then, to kind of get even, which really means the Department of Finance, to give you a sense of just how layered it can be up there, rated the reg fees on the reg fees on trucks to kind of get even. But look, if you kept a scorecard on who rated who and who's ahead, we're probably ahead in the general fund raid game. And now things are so tightly locked down between us, we kind of have a truce, like we won't raid you and you won't raid us. So I think on that score about being concerned about being raided, the issue that we're involved here on transportation, we're in pretty good shape. So I just wanted to answer that question for you.
I add something to that, if I may. I mean, if Marin County can leverage a quarter-cent sales tax for SMART for one project for the next 20 years, I don't see why, and that had to pass by a 70% vote, I don't see why it can't happen in other parts of the Bay Area. I mean, the sales tax is not some kind of, sacrosanct tax. It can always go up. I mean, and it will not inhibit that much spending. Another quarter sales tax any place is not going to prevent people from going down and buying big box items, and that's another source of revenue that we haven't tapped.
Let's hear from Bob, and then we'll hear from Randy.
Thank you. I just a couple questions on the last two. I think are the transportation utility tax. You mentioned a little bit about that. I haven't heard of that. It says here it's in Oregon. In Colorado, maybe, I guess the question I had on that was, is would that be a statewide effort, a regional effort?
So, we put it up there in part just to see if there was a way that we could capture this notion that, you know, transportation actually helps businesses, it helps the economy, and so forth and so on. It's very narrowly used, and it's in Oregon. It allows cities to do so, is what it does. And
okay.
They go through a process of making a calculation. It could be, let's say, a big box retailer shows up and there's an effect on their local streets. You know, you pay with your cable bill and your electric bill, often taxes similar to this. So it has not been done statewide. It's highly refined. I don't think in this state it's a realistic possibility.
And then the next question was on the regional development fee. I'm very familiar with these in East Contra Costa and the Tri-Valley and throughout the Bay Area, and they're substantially higher than 1,500 yeah. a unit in those two jurisdictions. But is this, you know, because you got a 50-plus percent, is the thought that that would be, like a regional fee? Or?
Well, what we tried to do here is to just kind of scrape the possibilities and put them all up on the screen, really. So, look, I think the notion, we hear from a lot of people that there ought to be one. You know, the impact of traffic, let's say, on a developer fee in Contra Costa just isn't on Highway 4. I mean, they get on the street, the next thing you know, they're on 680. So I think that there's this thought that there are some big enough developments that affect regional transportation and that we ought to be able to figure out a way to do that. Again, I think realistically speaking, this is the domain you often see of locales who are trying to deal with a specific problem. I think we haven't thought of much past that. But again, it's just to try to put everything out there so people can get a sense of the scale of what it would take to raise meaningful money.
I guess my only comment on that is, you know, you look at these two and they're relatively small in the grand revenue option, but could be significantly costly on the housing construction side,
and
prohibit what we're trying to do with the SES. So that, you know, would be my only editorial.
Look, I think you picked up the one thing. There are some things that are costly, both politically and, as you point out, for other things we're trying to achieve, and they don't get us that much.
Right.
So,
thank you.
Yes, and we're trying to not inhibit housing construction, that's for sure. Randy?
Well, in some areas.
Okay.
Those of us with the housing jobs imbalance, as long as it's affordable. So I try and look at things as what can we really influence and do? And I'm with Alan on this, that I think that with the right long-term focus, we're not going to get legislation in any time in the next year, maybe 2 years, but the appropriate lobbying and the appropriate educational forum where we start telling Californians, hey, Louisiana, they've got good roads because they do this, and it's Louisiana. So, you know, or...
We won't tell Louisiana.
You know, sorry, anybody from Louisiana. But, you know, and Alaskans, they get free money out of this. So we could be getting decent roads. We could be getting the potholes in front of your street fixed. We could be doing this, and that's what we haven't done enough of, is educating people as to what the benefits are for really no cost to them. And this whole, yeah, it's going to raise your gas. Our gas costs what our gas costs. And it actually, I think, costs more in a few other areas, but we're the highest people there, and we're not getting any benefit out of this. So I would be totally in support of that, and I think you guys really need to start working on that. Developers' fees are not going to fly. I can hear my developers right now, not going to happen, and I don't want to argue with them about it. So to me, that's one of those things where you're just going to generate a bunch of people arguing with each other and fighting with each other, whereas they can all agree. I would love to see a VMT on electric cars because they're not paying gas taxes, but that's not going to work, and that's not going to fly. So I think that a vehicle registration method is the way to go, and it is also the most equitable.
So, Randy, let me back you up, because look, this is the kind of feedback that we're looking for, so thank you. But I think, is the policy objective that electric cars should also have to pay? How we make that happen, I think your mind's more open about. Is that the case?
My mind is, because I think you can use I think what you can do, going back to educating people, say, well, look, we need to raise money, so either we put a VMT on electric vehicles or hybrids.
Or a reg fee or something like that.
Yeah. Okay. Or we do a registration fee. Okay. Well, the registration fee is going to be something that those people who feel that they're being unfairly targeted are going to get behind. And I think it's easier for people to pick up on a very small but very significant registration fee. And it is a more equitable way to go.
It's okay.
But, somewhere along the line, we have to address the fact that we can't keep pushing electric vehicles because they're not paying gas taxes.
Okay.
And I would just say, too, that they are contributing to operations and maintenance
fees. I mean, they're still on the road.
Yes.
They still wear out the pavement. So, Joanne?
This may be a naive question, but I don't get why we wouldn't do more with road usage charge in terms of the revenue that it generates. It shows on your chart. I mean, I don't spend a lot of time in Texas or Southern California, but the road usage. I mean, a registration fee would go along with it, but I could have a registered car that I didn't spend a lot of time on on the roads. I live in Napa County. I don't do a lot of traveling down to into the other parts of the region. But when I do, the condition of the roads is an important piece.
Right. So, look, I think your insight is pretty good. I mean, the state legislature has taken your opinion and passed a bill to do some sort of a pilot here in the state of California. When we say road user charge, I think we're probably being too cute by half. I mean, really, it's a VMT charge. That's essentially what it is. There's a lot of background noise, privacy and other concerns about VMT. It may not be so efficient to collect. There is a test in Oregon on the same subject. But, look, I think that you have a lot of shared views of many people out there who feel as though the best way to capture all the externalities and fairness is to go for a VMT.
Well, the Dallas area, incredible. Those are road tolls, but it's the same thing. You're paying for the usage.
And very similar, yes.
Their roads are phenomenal.
Yes. Yes.
Rich Hedges, and then Chris.
Actually, your vehicle miles traveled are already communicated to your insurance company through your smog test. It would be pretty easy for the state to get a hold of that and just use it based on miles traveled for registration fees.
Yes.
You wouldn't have to do it. So when people talk about, I don't want my privacy, well, your insurance company actually turns around and sells that information to credit card companies and everybody else. So your privacy is already gone on vehicle miles traveled. Because some time back, the insurance companies got the state to do that through state legislation.
I think a good deal of a lot of these things have nuance when it comes to public education, showing people where privacy is already going or its current state or what the benefits are from some of these changes, such as a fuel extraction.
My point is you don't have to do anything. It's already being transmitted.
Yeah.
That's a fair point.
And so there isn't through the smog tests.
Exactly. Chris?
I just want to add another voice in support of the oil extraction tax. This was brought up in the legislature in this past session by my senator, Noreen Evans. She's leaving the legislature at the end of this year, so somebody else needs to pick it up next year. And I also support the VMT. I think it's the most equitable way to do it. The gas tax is not working so well anymore because of a number of reasons, including electric cars and that it hasn't been changed in so long. But VMT is the most equitable way to go.
Thank you.
Jim?
Okay, I hope I'm on. Briefly, I just want to echo what is being talked about here. I do very much like the idea of the fuel extraction tax. It's amazing how it does work. I've been studying this along with Alan and others in Alaska and Louisiana, even Texas. So I think education is the way to go. It's not going to happen very quickly or immediately. It may take 2 or 3 years, but education is what is required. Now, on the BMT for the toll, I've traveled to the East Coast. They've got toll roads all over the place, I have to say. So they get an amazing amount of money. How would that work here? Would we put the BMT tax on the major freeways all throughout the state? How do you determine that?
So there's two ways to think about it. So if you are on a toll road, of which they do exist in California, a good number of them, you basically pay a toll to get on that road, and often that toll is based on time of day, but it's also relevant to how long that road is. So arguably you're paying kind of a toll for a distance. A VMT is generally seen as collected and paid by everybody. In Oregon, it's done through the gas pump, oddly enough. It could be done, as Mr. Hedges identified, through some sort of way that your mileage is reported to the state. And it's also seen as a replacement for the need for a gas tax. I mean, a gas tax, frankly, is a VMT fee, particularly if your car gets really lousy mileage. But that would be the general idea. It would be ubiquitous. It would be everywhere. It just wouldn't be a toll road.
All right, Bob?
Just one last. I didn't come prepared to have a conversation about VMT, but I just want to, you know, maybe throw out my comment from previous, too, the economic impact that a VMT tax could have on employment centers as well. I know that when this very discussion took place at the commission level, I think, I can't remember what committee or it was, but I remember Councilmember Bruner from Oakland raised the issue in her dealings with a lot of the unions, the labor unions, that, you know, a lot of folks can't find affordable housing close to their jobs, so unfortunately they are forced to travel from, you know, extensive great lengths to get to their job center. So just, you know, I think we've got a housing issue that, you know, we need to deal with that could solve that problem. I think there's a job issue in some communities where we have more housing than jobs, but just to throw that out for the, you know, as we look at that idea, there are other, obviously, I don't think anybody's saying there aren't, but just to make sure that we're keeping that focus.
And Jim, I'm sorry, did I see you have a follow-up comment at all, or no?
On the BMT, now the toll road tax, so you say it's done for a certain distance, so you have to you can only, let's say, go 50 or 60 miles, and then you got to pay again. Is that what you mean?
So, again, what I'm trying to do is just answer just the question about how it's used. In California, it's generally used as a fee to get on a highway. You have to pay that fee. It's not used everywhere for all travel. That's how it's done here. It could be done a lot of different ways. But when we talk about a VMT, we're not talking about a specific thing on the highway. We're talking about all vehicle miles traveled as a way to either augment or to replace the gas tax. That's generally speaking what it refers to.
Okay, I understand.
All right. Well, I really appreciate everyone's input on that. I would echo some of the concerns around the equity ramifications of these, but also support really around some of the VMT charges and the excise tax. I think there's room for further exploration on that, but I think we'll be exploring this a little further as we discuss the ledge agenda later on. Okay, wonderful. Oh, Richard? Sorry. Okay. All right. So with that, I think we'll wrap up this item. Then with that, let's move on to council member reports. If there are any upcoming... Oh, great. Naomi?
Thank you. I mentioned this in the subcommittee, but I wanted to mention it here, too. Alameda County's getting ready to host our annual mobility workshop for seniors and people with disabilities and people who are interested in that kind of transportation. And I will send Pam the save the date to forward to everyone. But we're going to have a panel about TNCs, which we think will be very interesting because it's been a very hot-button topic in the disabled community because it's had an impact on accessible taxis availability. We're also we're trying to put together a panel related to healthcare and transportation. So actually, if anybody has any ideas for panelists, I'd really welcome that because we're still working on that. And some other goodies. So I'll send that save the date. It's October 17th, which is a Friday, from about 9:30 to 3:30 at the Ed Roberts campus in Berkeley. Thank you.
Great. And then Rich and then Randy and Jim, do you have an announcement? I'll have Jim go first.
Yeah, I'm very much connected with the ILRC San Francisco, and I just have to say there were, back in July, we sent out a notice about the grand opening on Howard Street. They're no longer on Mission, and it was a great day. A lot of people came from all over the place. I don't know whether anyone other than me was there, but the notice did go out, and we'll be letting you know more what's going on there.
Great. Thank you. Rich and then Randy?
As I always do, I check out housing prices, and we have a new development on San Mateo Drive. Very nice complex. I wouldn't say it's anything extra special, but it's nice. The one bedrooms are 770 square feet, and the two bedrooms are around 1,000. The one bedrooms are 3,300 to 3,600, 38 to 4,000 on the two bedrooms. There is pet rent. Also, if you have a pet, it's $50 a month. Two pets, $100 a month. If you get a designated parking space, it's another $100 a month. So you figure it's $9,000 to get into the place with the $800. So as you can see, as we're building more units, the price isn't coming down. And I just keep wondering what in God's name people are going to do. Because when you tell people my age that these rents are out here, they call you a liar because they've lived in our homes so long. So it's hard to get that across to people that people are struggling so badly in this area. Also, remember to stick around. You all have a ticket for a gift from Marshall Loring, who's left the council and was a member here for 11 years.
Were those rents?
Those are rents, yeah.
You thought it was a down payment, didn't you?
I think Joanne just exemplified the shock you were talking about.
I reported that to my homeowners association last night, and actually some fairly younger people looked at me like, you must be out of your mind. No, it's right here.
Welcome to San Mateo Burlingame.
Up to almost 4,000.
And we'll go ahead and hold that after adjournment,
yeah,
and then
adjournment.
Randy?
Thank you. I think we should have asked the legislative group to put affordable housing because that really does impact, it impacts our roads because that's just obscene. That wasn't what I was going to say, though.
Well, if I could just add something
to that. Well, no, it's my turn. Wait, just wait. For those of us who have been around for a few years, I was just advised before this meeting that Jennifer Yeamans, who worked closely with us on the equity. She's the one that helped us devise all our pretty maps. And she sat through some pretty insufferable meetings. But she's the one who was just our cornerstone for our equity analysis for many years. This is her last day.
What?
So, yeah. I'm very, very unhappy, and I would just like on behalf of our group to send Jennifer on her way with just all the love and blessings we can, because I don't know what we would have done without her. She's been she's just been a gem. So, Pam, if you would not mind passing along the fact that I'm telling her I didn't give her permission to leave, and we didn't do that, but just to send our blessings along with her.
Yes, I was not aware of that, and she really ushered through a phenomenal amount of work and a phenomenal amount of meetings, and did a service to the entire region, I think, in doing so. I will share one brief announcement, and that's a very local thing in Napa. Tomorrow there's a 9/11 commemoration celebration at the Napa 9/11 Memorial on Main Street at First Street in Napa. It begins at 5:30 p.m. And so with that, Chris. Thank you. An announcement from Chris.
Sorry, one last thing. The smart rail system in Sonoma County has been recommended for a ATP grant, active transportation, about $8.1 million. And I'm not sure what's next for that, but I want to say that is good for all parties involved in both for smart, for the city of Santa Rosa, for the residents of that area, which this is a bicycle pedestrian bridge over the tracks that will keep SMART from closing another crossing in downtown Santa Rosa and provide really good access and safety for low-income kids on one side of the tracks getting to their school on the other side of the tracks. So whatever can be done to keep that moving forward would be great.
congratulate a lot of the regional active transportation program grant recipients. There are some great projects that have been moved forward. So with that, I think we're adjourned. Thank you, everyone. See you next month. Oh, I'm sorry. We have one more item. My apologies. Very briefly, any new business for the Policy Advisory Council? Rich Hedges. We'll do. We'll work with Pam on that on an agenda. Thank you. All right. Any other new business? Seeing none, we're adjourned. Thank you.